I'm deeply concerned that you're going to have direct corporate spending to influence the election of candidates as early as this fall.
Alaska lawmakers react to a U.S. Supreme Court decision on campaign spending. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 22nd of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking for adult mentors to help foster care youth as they leave the system.
They have nowhere to go on the holidays. They have no one to call if they have a flat tire. They have no supportive adults in their lives.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaskans are trying to understand the full effects of yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision that will allow corporations to become more involved in electioneering and political campaigns. The decision overturned parts of the 2002 McCain-Feingold Act and its own earlier rulings that prohibited corporations from using their money to make and run advertisements for or against issues or individual candidates. Alaska has corporate restrictions in place for state campaigns, and Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French announced on the Senate floor today that he will initiate hearings on the decision to find out exactly how it will affect Alaska politics. He called the ruling disastrous for the future of democracy.
60 years of jurisprudence yesterday was thrown out on a 5-4 decision from a bitterly divided Supreme Court led by an individual who many point out, Justice John Roberts, who promised during his confirmation hearings to simply call balls and strikes. It was a narrow case that never raised these issues. The court more or less brought them up on its own and asked for further briefing, surprising many legal observers. And now we have a ruling that is going to blast a hole in not only federal laws, but our laws here in the state of Alaska. Our restrictions on corporate spending are now pushed aside.
French says he will hold hearings as soon as he can schedule them, presenting expert testimony on how widespread the decision might be and what restrictions the state can put on spending in Alaska campaigns.
My understanding is that it's going to apply to both state and federal elections because, you know, the supreme law of the land is the United States Constitution and the rulings that come out of the Supreme Court. So we've got to first hash out whether or not and how deeply it applies to state elections. That's going to be my focus. But I'm deeply concerned that you're going to have direct corporate spending to influence the election of candidates as early as this fall.
Following French's announcement of hearings, Anchorage Republican Con Bundy said he believes money does not buy elections.
Perhaps in Alaska, if not in other parts of the United States, money may be a factor, but it is not the only factor. And integrity and talent and willingness to serve still may well serve people who wish to run for office.
Attorney General Dan Sullivan has yet to make a statement concerning the decision's effect on Alaska. Late last night, an ACE cargo plane crashed on takeoff from Sandpoint. Search efforts have been underway since early this morning. Two people were on board. Before the Coast Guard arrived, local fishing vessels searched the waters around Sandpoint. From member station KSDP, Kels Hetherington reports.
The Coast Guard received a report from the Sandpoint Police Department at about 12:20 a.m. this morning that a Beechcraft 1900 had gone into the water. Coast Guard spokeswoman Petty Officer Sarah Francis says,
"We arrived on scene first with a C-130. They're a little bit faster than the helicopters. The helicopter crew arrived about 1 hour later, and they both searched for quite some time out there on scene. And we have another crew headed out there this morning to take over from the folks who flew all night."
By 11 a.m. on Friday, the Coast Guard had searched Chopoff Strait and was looking at the debris field around the Egg Islands. The Coast Guard reported finding pieces of the aircraft, mostly larger items, including an airplane seat. At the time of the accident, Sandpoint was under partly cloudy skies with winds at 45 knots, gusting to 55 knots. It's unclear now if the NTSB will investigate the accident. Kels Hetherington reporting from Sandpoint.
Doyon has announced plans to explore for oil and gas in the Yukon Flats this winter. The Interior Native Regional Corporation will work with the village corporations for Birch Creek and Stevens Village on the seismic survey project, which will scan a 95-mile-long swath of native lands in the vicinity of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. About 15 to 20 tribal members from Stevens Village are expected to work on this winter's exploration project. Doyon spokeswoman Sharon McConnell says the support of village residents who work in the exploration area is key to the project.
The efforts in this area this winter are just part of a multi-year plan to conduct additional exploration on resource, natural resource projects on Doyon lands. And an important part of this plan really is to work closely with local communities to assure a meaningful economic state in any of our projects.
Access to the remote exploration area will be by helicopter and snow machine to minimize environmental impacts. McConnell says the area has been identified by the U.S. Geological Survey as having a high gas and oil potential. The project follows a failed attempt by Doyon to broaden its exploration and development scope in the Yukon Flats through a land swap with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This winter's Yukon Flats survey project follows drilling of an exploratory well near Nenana last summer. Doyon has not released drilling results. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book of national park photography.
My goal with the book was to not play on the fear and saying, well, look at all these things that we're going to lose. It was more like, look at all these things that we have. Put on your boots, go out there and enjoy them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
Describing 2009 as an adventure likely to continue into 2010, the head of Anchorage's Convention and Visitors Bureau yesterday presented the organization's annual report on Anchorage's visitor industry. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Julie Soppy, president and CEO of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, used adventure in its widest sense. She began with what she called the tremendous challenges and harsh business climate of 2009.
The recession hit travelers and, by extension, businesses financially. Mother Nature put a cramp in Alaska's travel industry as well, with H1N1 threatening to derail business and eruptions at Mount Redoubt hampering air travel several times this year. We are seeing a different kind of traveler this year as well, one who is tighter with money and looking for the best deal.
Those negative influences appear in a telling financial tally for 2009.
As of early November, the bed tax collected totaled over $15 million, with the projected total reaching approximately $17.5 million. These are big numbers, but when all is said and done, we anticipate bed taxes in 2009 to be roughly 21% lower than 2008's collection.
In one of the short video clips interspersed throughout Soppy's report, Barry Swanberg of Phillips Cruises and Tours offered a historical perspective of 2009 and probably 2010.
I went through the downturn in the 80s. I went through the 9/11 downturn, which was very severe. And now this one, which is truly the worst I've ever seen. But we'll come back. We always do.
Soppy says 2009 was not all bad news. Despite a reduced budget and a cut staff, the Convention and Visitors Bureau registered several victories. Meeting and convention bookings include the Texas Ski Council in March with 500 delegates, a large Lions Club contingent in 2011, 900 delegates of the American Avalanche Association in September 2012, and in the same month, 750 members of the Avionics Maintenance Conference. Soppy says these and other conferences translate into tens of millions of dollars. But as for 2010 and the individual or family travelers?
Travel is down in all segments. The U.S. Travel Association reports that declines in travel are bottoming out, meaning that 2010 will be marginally better than 2009, but not a return to previous positive years. Real post-recession growth is most likely up to 2 years away, according to industry experts.
That drop in travelers includes international visitors.
The recession, as we know, was worldwide and as a result has influenced the international market. Travel to the U.S. was down 8.2% by third quarter 2009. It isn't expected to rebound until possibly 2013.
Sapi says ACVB has budgeted another 10% decrease for 2010, based primarily on the announced Alaska redeployment of the cruise industry. The redeployments will mean an estimated 117,000 fewer overnight cruise visitors coming to Anchorage in 2010 than last year. Nevertheless, Sapi points to possible, if not blue skies, at least a lighter shade of gray for Anchorage's visitor industry in 2010.
This city remains the hub of economic activity for the state and the Alaska travel industry. Indeed, we are beginning to see signs, early though they may be, of a modest recovery. Several domestic air carriers plan to add service to Anchorage in the months ahead. And we are excited that the Port of Anchorage will host 9 Holland America Line arrivals of well over 1,000 people each in 2010. There is also optimism that the Travel Promotion Act will soon clear all procedural hurdles in the U.S. Congress and perhaps provide a boost to international travel.
Julie Sapi, President and CEO of the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau, presenting her annual report to the ACVB membership. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Forty percent of youth that come out of foster care in Alaska end up homeless at some time as adults. This dismal statistic has inspired a new program to match young people who are leaving foster care with adult mentors who will help them navigate the sometimes scary waters of life on your own. Amanda Mativier is the statewide coordinator for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. Mativier was in foster care as a teenager. She says the available services for young adults is missing some key connections.
Say a youth is going on to college. The university provides 10 tuition waivers a year for youth that age out of foster care. But we're finding that youth don't make it past the first year of college because they have nowhere to go on the holidays. They have no one to call if they have a flat tire. They have no supportive adults in their lives.
And if you don't mind talking about it, how was it for you as you became an adult and had to go out on your own? Did you have any support or how was that?
I was actually lucky, and I say that because a lot of older youth in foster care, usually if they're over 16, they're unlikely to become adopted or get any kind of permanent placement. So it usually means at 18 they're on their own. I was lucky in the sense that I had only one foster care placement. I extended foster care until I was 20, which you can extend till 20 in Alaska. I stayed with my foster parents till I was 22. They said as long as I was going to school or I had some sort of goal of higher education, I could stay with them. And they continued to be my family after foster care. And so I was lucky in the sense that I connected with the family. But a lot of our youth don't have that.
You mentioned that sometimes young people are in numerous placements. What's your experience talking with youth in Alaska about, is there an average number of homes that they're in?
I've heard everything from in the 20s, 30s, 40s, some even in the 50s. Some would say they lost count. I think it's a higher number of placement changes for youth in Anchorage. People are hesitant to take in teenagers. And so what happens is young people will initially go into emergency placement, which is only supposed to be 30 days. And so once that 30 days is up and if they haven't identified another placement that's potentially permanent, they'll go into another emergency placement. And that cycle might continue, or they might go into a shelter. A lot of youth that are older in foster care will be placed at Covenant House or sometimes residential treatment facilities just because there's nowhere to put them. We had one of our members last year who was actually placed at McLaughlin because there was nowhere for him to go.
Do you have a picture in your mind, Amanda, of what an ideal mentor would be?
I think it just looks like somebody in the community that's going to be supportive. So maybe taking youth out to, you know, out to eat or to the movies, and really just in the beginning stages, getting to know them, building a relationship, building that trust. Because for a lot of foster youth, it's hard to trust adults when you have so many coming in and out of your life, and you have a lot of false promises. So I think initially it'll just be that developing a relationship, and then hopefully in the future it's someone that they can call, you know, if they lock themselves out of their house, or they get a flat tire, or they just need a vent. They just need someone to talk to.
Amanda Mativier is the statewide coordinator for Facing Foster Care in Alaska. The program will be administered by Alaska Community Services. Executive Director Mike Seville says the statistics bowled them over and they wanted to help. Alaska Community Services currently oversees the foster grandparent and senior companion programs, so it's a good fit. He says they've begun recruiting mentors and are looking for around 20 to 25 people.
We'll be working with Office of Children's Services, and they'll be referring youth to us that would like to have a mentor, and we'll be matching people up. It's going to be a process that takes a couple of months probably for someone to get in, because you have screening and background checks and matching interests and just the human side of a match, where people are comfortable with each other. And so it'll take a little while to get matched. And once that's done, then we'll supervise that, and we'll keep track of how it's going and keep track of the success that I'm sure we'll have.
Seville says they offer their other programs in Fairbanks and Southeast Alaska, and eventually the plan is to move beyond Anchorage to these locations with the Foster Mentor Program also.
I think that ultimately there's a need in both Dillingham, Bethel, and probably Nome as well. So an awful lot of need across the state. So ultimately, if we can get some funding to do that expansion, then we'll be certainly statewide.
Seville says his office has no funding to take up the program, but he says his staff felt strongly enough about helping foster kids aging out of the system that they took on the extra work anyway.
These are young folks that are in the foster care system through no fault of their own, and they don't have, for the most part, those individuals that are stable, intergenerational type relationships to guide them along the way. And if you can make a difference in one person's life, it's worthwhile for you to do that.
Anchorage Democrat Representative Les Guerra is a strong supporter of foster care reform. Guerra and Senator Betty Davis are proposing legislation to provide better educational support and job training assistance for youth within foster care. Guerra says currently there is no specific legislation for the Foster Mentor Program, but the idea has been pitched to the governor's office, and Guerra hopes the concept could be added to current mentorship programs.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
The Federal Subsistence Board surprised many hunters in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta by reopening the moose hunting season there. Now a massive chunk of land will be open for another month. The decision came after requests by the Yukon Delta Wildlife Refuge and two tribes from the village of Marshall. The area has seen a rapid rise in the moose population there. In their decision, the Subsistence Board cited poor travel conditions during the previous winter hunt. Chuck Ardizian is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
People hadn't been able to get out there to harvest, and the moose population could handle some additional harvest. I think it allows subsistence users to get out there and harvest moose if they hadn't already.
Many families in the lower Yukon are relying more on moose meat after years of decreased salmon runs and increased fishing restrictions. The hunt in that area between the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers was previously closed on January 20th. It reopened today and will stay open until February 28th. The hunt has also been liberalized to allow for the taking of cow and calf moose, as well as bulls. A new book capturing breathtaking images of selected national parks is out by photographer Ian Shive. Scenes from across the country are captured within the pages of The National Parks, Our American Landscape. Shive says the majority of the pictures are digital, although some of his film archives made the cut also. He says he takes 4,000 to 5,000 images in each place before editing down to a few. The project spans 4.5 years, although Shive says when the book concept became reality, things moved much quicker.
Then I had 4 months to shoot about 30% of that book. And so then it became a bit of a challenge. I had 7,500 miles in 20 days and 17 parks around the American West. And I did several trips just to pick up things I felt like I needed. And I'm a perfectionist. So even though I could have probably done a book right from day one, I wanted to go out and say, all right, well, if this is going to really happen, I want it to be awesome and get out there and just really do my best.
For Alaska, Denali is the only one that made the cut for your book. How did you decide what to include and what to leave out, particularly here in Alaska?
Well, there's 300, and at the time, there were 391 national park units. So if you had one photo from each, it'd be a book that no one would publish just because it'd be way too large. And I had to somehow sift through all these magnificent places. You could do a book on each park, really. And so I needed it to make the book a personal journey. I needed to just look at how do I experience the parks and what are the greatest moments and the places that I had the greatest emotional connections to. And that was going to be the best way to edit it down. Otherwise, I think you'd just drive yourself crazy trying to figure out how do I do more of Yellowstone and not of Acadia or Everglades. And so I made it a personal journey in those more poignant moments. And the truth is, really, the idea for the book project originated here in Alaska, and it originated on an assignment, and I was embedded in a search and rescue crew on Mount McKinley, and I'd seen the national parks in such a unique way and been given such a rare opportunity to have this perspective of not only what these guys do up on McKinley, but just that view of Denali. I mean, people think of Denali, they think of the valley and the mountain in the distance. I had the reverse view. I was on the mountain looking back into that valley, and so for me, Alaska kind of triggered that idea. And so Denali was the most significant emotional connection I had and was such a significant part of my own journey as a photographer. So that's how that made the main inclusion.
In an age of a struggling industry, when publishers are not taking too many chances on expensive books, particularly, mm-hmm. why is a book like this important? What can photography do to help with parks preservation?
Well, I think photography and art in the parks in general, painting, has always played a significant role, certainly since the beginning of the national parks themselves. But I've learned firsthand that photography is incredibly relevant in two ways. The first is my goal with this book is to inspire people. In general, the environmental movement has a lot of fear right now. There's a lot of the last chance to save a polar bear, last chance to save the wolf. And I kind of wonder how many people have ever seen either of those things in person. Why do they feel this connection to that? And so my goal with the book was to not play on the fear and saying, well, look at all these things that we're going to lose. It was more like, look at all these things that we have. Put on your boots, go out there and enjoy them. And I guarantee when they do that, then they'll start to feel a sense of connection. And that photography will be the beginning point, a catalyst for them to find their own conservation values. And I think that that's the best I can really ever hope for.
Photographer Ian Shive will be signing copies of the National Parks, Our American Landscape tonight at Barnes & Noble in Anchorage. Links to his work are at our website, aprn.org. At one time long ago, whalers from Alaska, Massachusetts, and Hawaii all worked together off Alaska's shores. Now their descendants in all those regions are working to blend three or more different cultures in a unique theater production that will have its first run at Anchorage's Alaska Native Heritage Center this weekend. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Is it throwing you off?
I have a cue. It's throwing me off.
Okay. So do you want just like a... Ooh. No real words.
Actress Allison Akachuk-Warden tends to some last-minute details during the final dress rehearsal of a performing arts showcase with the working title Celebration, Song, Dance, and Story. The production will have its initial run this weekend at the Alaska Native Heritage Center's first Native Theater Festival. Then it heads to the North Slope for a three-day run. After that, Hawaii, Mississippi, and Massachusetts beckon. Ed Bourgeois is tour manager for the production.
We all came together in October and during the course of a week put together a piece. So there are contributions from all the artists. They have their own songs and dances and stories. And then Tau Dance Theater in Honolulu, Hawaii, Tau is also the name of the director. He came over, all the artists convened and met. And then during the course of the week, he has a process of developing a piece out of everyone's story.
The production is the latest offering of a collaborative effort sponsored by the Federal Education Through Cultural and Historical Organizations Program, or ECHO, which uses Department of Education funds for cultural exchange programs. Each of the actors in the production is sponsored by a regional museum.
Originally, it was a collaboration of three basic institutions, the Alaskans, Hawaiians, and New Bedford. And it was all around whaling. And whaling involved all of these three cultures. A lot of people don't know that the New Bedford whalers had deckhands that were Alaska Native, and they would spend part of the time in Alaska and then go down to Hawaii, and they had Hawaiian deckhands, and all the trade between all of those areas based in the whaling trade. And then it just sort of grew over time. And so we brought in more indigenous cultures that were interested.
The recent Choctaw connection explains the Mississippi leg of the tour. Stephen Blanchett represents the Alaska Native Heritage Center in the ensemble piece. Fairbanks-raised Allison Warden represents the Inupiaq Heritage Center in Barrow.
Well, we have Inupiaq, which is myself. I'm representing the Inupiaq Heritage Center in the North Slope Borough. And we have a Wampanoag from Massachusetts. I haven't been to their land yet. We have someone from Hawaii. We have a Portuguese fisherman representing. We all represent different museums.
Warden has acted for 20 years, getting her first stage experience with Perseverance Theater in Juneau. She says for this production, she must stay in character as an Inupiaq woman.
I'm representing my whole people. I was chosen by the North Slope Borough and the Inupiaq Heritage Center to be a representative of the Inupiaq people, so I need to be very mindful of that in everything that we do on stage.
After a series of school performances in Anchorage, the play travels to Barrow, Kaktovik, and Anaktuvik Pass during its North Slope run. The production can be seen by Anchorage general audiences on Saturday at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Oh, that was so fun!
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Kels Hetherington in Sandpoint, Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.